Great. Welcome, everybody. My name is Omar Tulan. I'm the associate dean here at the Faculty of Management. And on behalf of Dean Todd, myself, all of our colleagues, I'd like to welcome you today to a very special event for us. It's an honor here to have with us Principal Heather Monroe Bloom for what we're calling today a conversation with the principal. It's your opportunity to hear not only from the leader of our university, but from one of the education leaders of Canada. Principal Monroe Bloom, who assumed the position in 2003 as McGill's first female principal and vice chancellor, is also a professor of medicine. As a distinguished psychiatric epidemiologist, she has dedicated her career to the advancement of education, especially advising governments and other organizations on the role that universities and research should play in advancing society and international competitiveness. Professor Monroe Bloom serves also on numerous not-for-profit and private boards. She is president of the Conférence des recteurs et des principaux des universités du Québec, and she also serves on the executive committees of the Association of Universities and Colleges of Canada and the Association of American Universities. She is also on the boards of the Jewish General Hospital, the Conférence de Montréal, the Yellow Pages Group, and the Canada Forum of Rio Tinto Alcan. Professor Monroe Bloom holds a PhD with distinction in epidemiology from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She also holds a master's degree from Wilfrid Laurier University and a bachelor's degree from McMaster University. Among her numerous awards and honors, she is an officer of the Order of Canada. She's also an elected fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, as well as a Grande Montréalaise, as well as in 2009 she was elected to the National Order of Quebec. So it's a great pleasure to have with us Principal Monroe Bloom. The format of today's event will be as follows. We have representatives from our four largest programs here at the faculty, our BCom, our MBA, our Executive MBA, and our PhD program. And each of the representatives will have roughly 10 minutes to interview the principal, as well as at the end, our BCom representative will be putting forth several questions which were submitted online from the audience. Our first interviewer is Mr. Matthew Atwood. He is a U3 BCom student studying international management, finance, and Chinese. He has worked for Chinese pharmaceutical companies in Beijing and Shanghai, as well as for Pfizer, and most recently completed a term with BMO Capital Markets in Toronto, where he will join with a full-time position this coming July. Our second interviewer representing the MBA program will be Mr. Mike Ross. He is currently in his first year in the program. Previously, Mike worked as a finance lawyer in New York, London, and Boston, as well as running a development project in the Middle East and working for eBay Canada, as well as serving as a member of the Royal Highland Regiment of Canada. This summer, Mike will be joining McKinsey & Company as a summer associate in their Montreal office here in Montreal. Thirdly, we have Mr. Florent Francourt, who is representing our EMBA program. Florent has been president and CEO of the Ordre des Conseillers en Ressources Humaines Agréées since 1992. Under his leadership, the Order's membership has risen from 800 to nearly 9,500. He is also a member of the Canadian Council of Human Resource Associations and was the first Canadian to serve as president and CEO of the World Federation of Personnel Management Associations. And finally, we have Ms. Caroline Roux. Caroline is a fourth-year PhD student here in the marketing area. Her research interests lie in consumer behavior and psychology. She currently holds an SSHRC doctoral scholarship and has presented her research at the Association for Consumer Research and the Society for Consumer Psychology conferences. So please join me in welcoming our interviewers as well as our keynote speaker, and I'll pass the floor over to Matthew to begin the session.
Thank you very much, Associate Dean. So I would just, first of all, like to thank you. I know your schedule is very busy, and opportunities like this don't come up very often. So once again, just thank you very much for being here today. The first question that I have for you is, you've described McGill as a research-intensive institution. However, for undergraduate students, we often are unable to participate in these endeavors. What concrete and measurable steps have you taken to ensure that McGill is an institution for everyone and not just an institution for researchers?
Great question. And, McGill is almost 200 years old. We were founded on a college of medicine, rich in practice, teaching and research from the beginning. And without question, although that has remained our core activity as an institution as we've grown exponentially in size over the decades, we are known internationally for a couple of things, and one of them, without question, is the quality of our research and scholarship, depending on which discipline you're in. And so it is a challenge for a university that's research-intensive to say, how do we bring that wonderful enterprise of research and scholarship to bear on the experience of undergraduate students as well as graduate and professional students? And to that end, I launched a task force on student life and learning 5 years ago or so, and a number of recommendations have come out of that, and on the basis of those recommendations, the administration, under the leadership of the provost, responded to the recommendations, and we undertook a number of interventions to improve the quality of student life and learning, because as much as we're known around the world for the quality of our research, there's no question that our students, and our very much our undergraduate students, rank with the very best in the world. And you should benefit, not suffer, because of the research that happens here. So we have a number of interventions. Each faculty has been charged to come up with some opportunities for undergraduate students to work in, depending again on the field, research labs, survey research, research projects, to work on a research grant of a professor through the year. And we've made a lot of progress on that. In fact, each faculty now reports annually to the provost on what new interventions there are. The goal now is to share best practices, so that to take the faculties that have done this and had successes having, soup and science lunches, to internships in research, to joint initiatives even in the international context where undergraduate as well as graduate students participate, to say, can we now continue to expand that so that somewhere in your undergraduate program every student would have an opportunity to do something in the research realm, but also to have it so that you could be studying Zola studies but do some research in engineering, or you could be an engineering student or a management student and do something in English or in philosophy or law. And so that's the next step. And it's a very collaborative initiative, and I really urge you to keep expressing an interest in that.
Excellent. Okay. Perhaps on the heels of that, participation in administration is obviously very important. When you consider organizational behavior theory and things of that nature, I mean, increasing ownership and increasing accountability and I guess how you identify with the program is very important, especially for students. So when you talk of something like the task force on student life and learning, how is student participation being included in initiatives such as those?
Well, I think it's very important that, and we'll talk a little bit about leadership as we go on, I really believe in distributed responsibility and distributed leadership. And so I think that has to happen first at the local level. If there isn't a good culture and encouragement for participation of students at the departmental level, at the faculty level, anything that happens at the institutional level will be disconnected from the students' learning experience. And so faculties do that, certainly through the faculty-student councils, through leadership roles within the faculty. And then when I think about the senior administration, we have a number of mechanisms. One is I have pizza with the principal at lunches. Sometimes they're actually not lunch. Sometimes they're at 11 in the morning. Sometimes they're at 5 in the afternoon, but people are always hungry and pizza gets eaten. That's a great way for me to meet with students who don't hold formal student leadership roles at the university, and that's a big issue for me. That's why I love doing this kind of event, because, as you said, the schedule is very tightly framed, and so meeting with people who don't have official leadership roles is something in a big institution like this that everybody's challenged to do. So Senate and the Board of Governors are other ways. We meet with the executives of the various student associations on a regular basis. I met with SMU and PGSS last week, and with PGSS Council last week. I meet with the amalgam of the student councils at the faculty level through SMU try to do that at least annually. We'd like to do it twice a year. And then town halls. This week I'll be doing a town hall out at McDonald campus. These are, of course, the town halls are for all members of the community, but it's a special opportunity for students. One of the challenges, and I put that back to you, is we have a system of leadership at the university that I think doesn't adequately represent the some 50,000 people who make up our community day in and day out on our two campuses, and then we have our hospitals on top of that. And so we tend to, through our governing bodies, for example, see the same people all the time. They're terrific, and that's not bad, but it's a very tiny representation of the total population of students or faculty or administrative and support staff. And so finding more ways of doing this kind of informal exchange and hearing what you'd like to do to participate is very important. And maybe I'll just finish on one example of students owning an area where they asserted their participation and changed the university, and that's in the sustainability area.
Perhaps I could build off sustainability just a little bit. We often hear about socially conscious education. However, one has to wonder how much airtime it's really given in a faculty such as management. So from your personal perspective, what do you think the role of socially conscious education should be in management education, in something like finance or marketing, in that regard?
Well, you'll be the judges of how well we do at it. I'm not as well positioned as you are to say we do or don't do it, but I think there's a tremendous role for that and a growing role for it, and to do it in an interdisciplinary way as well. If you think increasingly about we're proud in Quebec and in Canada and certainly at McGill of our social values, and I started life as a social worker and embraced that, but you quickly bump up against the fact that we can't afford our social values if we don't have economic productivity. Similarly, what good is economic productivity if there isn't a sense of community and social engagement and building a sense of community at an individual level, but at a collective level as well.
Okay. Now, when you speak of economics, there's obviously a lot of economics that are at play in administering a university. And so when we consider, the administration of economics, we often consider the corporate model or the corporate structure. Now, when you're administering somewhere like McGill, do you think of it as a corporation, or do you ascribe it to kind of a unique category of administration?
Great question. We are a university, first and foremost, and so the lens through which I see all administrative decisions made is the lens of the mission of the university, and we have an unbelievably noble university mission, and it is to provide teaching, research, scholarship, and service of the highest quality by international standards. To be sensitive to student life and learning and how we bring our activities to bear on the preparation of the people who come through our doors, and to play the role as a public university locally and in Canada as well. So the mission is there. At the same time, we have annual revenues of over $1 billion a year. We have the biggest real estate holdings on the Montreal Island. As I said, we have a community of some 50,000 people. And we have a broad range of disciplines that touch society, both locally and internationally, in a range of ways. So we are a university. The fundamental values of a university govern all of our decisions, integrity, freedom of speech and thought, the ability to pursue areas intellectually and professionally that may be constrained in other environments. And at the same time, the competition to produce teaching, research, and scholarship of excellence in today's environment is so intense that if we are not very strategic about the way we think about expressing our mission, we will simply fall behind. I believe you move forward or you fall back. There's no holding steady. And so we have to be very prudent in thinking about what is our strategic plan, what are our priorities, how to express that mission according to priorities. And at the same time, as we understand that, 50,000 flowers bloom at McGill, not 1,000, that there are some areas that without concerted, disciplined effort simply will undermine the ability of the university and our faculties to do what we're here to do. So bringing professional skills and experience and sensibility accountability in administration and in governance, and frankly, in the quality of our research and our teaching, and our and the people who come into the university are very disciplined. And the approach to doing that today is more complicated, more demanding, and more professionalized than it's been in the thousands of years that universities have been around.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much. I'd like to pass it off to Mike Ross, who will.
Thanks. Well, actually, what I'd like to do is to start actually by building on something you said earlier about your leadership style. And I think that, you know, obviously here in the business school, we're learning about leadership style through a lens of business. But you grew up or came up through a science background. And I'm just wondering whether you've seen that that science background has informed the way that you deal with people, the way that you lead people.
Well, some people say my background in social work and psychiatry probably positioned me best to do the job that I do today. But it actually goes back further for me, and I don't know how much in management you talk about this, but I grew up in a six-child family. I was the only girl. I was the second eldest, and so started young in teamwork, and in probably also in taking some leadership because there was kind of a default to me. Within the family, and that was a fabulous experience. I learned through talking, and that can be intimidating to people because I assert my ideas, but I'm really open to hearing other points of view, and I depend on people pushing back in expressing their views. And I would say, without exception, I'm always smarter for hearing others' points of view, for consulting, for collaborating, and as I said, I see leadership as a really distributed and broad team effort. Science came late because I worked as a psychiatric social worker. My first degrees were social work and sociology, and then a master's in social work, and I worked in academic psychiatry units in the first instance associated with McMaster in Hamilton, where we did community outreach and inpatient work as well. And what I found was that, again, the values and the commitment of me and the people who were working together were very strong. But more and more in that era, evidence-based practice was being raised. You know, did we know that what we were doing made a difference, whether it was a psychological intervention or a community action or, frankly, biological treatment for depression or anxiety or a psychotic disorder? And that took me to science. And I'd say that without ever having had a career path, when I went to do my PhD in my late 20s, my brain burned for 3 years because I was shifting from one side of the brain to the other side of the brain, moving out of social sciences and humanities and interpersonal things into, you know, studying biology, mostly with people who had an MD, and learning computers, and I was at the tail end of the mainframe computer side, and I had never touched a computer before. So in my late 20s, it was crash immersion. And I think the scientific method was helpful. It satisfied enormously my appetite for an empirical basis for informing decisions. But it also taught me what a great educational program is and how the ability to try things and fail is as important as getting yourself into a stream where you're just going to succeed. You know, taking on things where you're interested but unproven is really important. So I'd say now all of those things, from family to social work to sociology to being married to a musician who became a screenwriter to the scientific enterprise, all of those.
That's excellent. I mean, we've definitely learned that as well, that sort of good leaders are made from all those different particular influences. But another thing that actually you just raised now, which I found particularly interesting, is this notion of sort of trying new things.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and one of the things that we learn, again, you know, in business school, is this notion that a really good strategy for a business or a university or any other organization is one that anticipates change and also is difficult to replicate, right? It's something that is going ahead of everybody else. It's not just keeping up with the Joneses, but it's actually doing something that... leading a pack, and also leading a pack in a way that's difficult for other people to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
Are there things that McGill's doing now or that you see McGill doing in the next little while that really strike at that?
Yeah, great question, and that goes back to my earlier point on having a strategy and leadership now being still leadership of an academic institution, but having a strategy. And part of that, and this may be true across organizations from business enterprises to NGOs to universities and government, is knowing what your distinctive strengths are and knowing what your distinct vulnerabilities are. And so, you know, at McGill we have a real clear sense. We have a wonderful position in Quebec, historically Anglophone university with a deeply Francophone population, and 55% of our students come from Quebec. But we're the only public university in Canada that also has 25% of our students as pan-Canadian from literally, and I just talked to a number of you who represent this demographic, every major region in Canada, including up to Iqaluit in the north. And then we have, even at the undergraduate level, almost 20% full-time international students, in addition to all of you who come from other countries but are landed immigrants or citizens. You know, 20% who come from about 160 countries a year. So that international, pan-Canadian, and deeply Quebec character is a big advantage. Second, we have the best students in the world. We have no legacy system. You can't buy your way into this university. For all of you who are students, you should feel terrific. No one got you here but yourself. And we're the only university. We belong to this distinguished group of the Association of American Universities. It's the American Ivies and their public equivalents. We're the only one that there's no way in but just on the basis of your intellectual gifts and your performance to that point. So that's a huge attraction for outstanding faculty members. Then we were founded, as I said, on a college of medicine. Around half of our enterprise is related to the health sciences today. And we are, by DNA, interdisciplinary. You know, if a provost or a dean or a principal came in and said, you know, we're going to make a new plan, we're going to make this an interdisciplinary place, you would fail, because you've got to just organically work that way, that you're curious about other areas. And I think of interdisciplinarity in a T formation, deep, deep knowledge and expertise within an area, and then a real curiosity and competence in building across and working with people who know those and master those other fields. And then I'll just give you one more on the advantage side, is that we are very graduate student intensive. We're more like the great American universities than the great Canadian universities, research intensive universities, in the sense that about a quarter of our students are graduate students, and that fits the research mission and enterprise, and it should allow for a deep experience at the undergraduate level and more to do on that. But we're making strides there. On the what do we have to deal with tactically and strategically, that's a disadvantage, it is our funding framework. And you know, you folks know better than most the ins and outs of that. It's complicated. But our goal is accessibility and quality, and the two have to come together in a public policy framework.
And just, to shift gears a little bit, can we talk a little bit about mentoring?
Sure.
And
great.
Both sort of in terms of mentors that you've had, but also are you currently serving as a mentor for other people? And
Great. Well, first of all, it's a terrific. Are you waving that at us? Okay. So I'm talking to
our.
We've got a wrap up page up here that will. So fantastic, important. I think everybody should play a mentoring role. I think about my daughter's karate class, where, you know, when she was, she's now in her 20s, but when she was five, parents and kids took karate together, and you moved at the rate of your ability so that kids ended up teaching parents and more often than not, and it was a total mélange. We can all learn from each other, and what mentoring is different depending on how it's expressed. So I've benefited from enormous mentors. Interestingly, in my generation, even in social work, they tended to be men in the profession, and early days it was often psychiatrists who all said, go to medical school, go to medical school, which I didn't want to do, and I'm glad I had another mentor who said, you know, if you don't want to do that, don't do that, do something different. And I did the PhD in epidemiology. My mother said, couldn't you do a PhD in something that she could tell her friends about? But that's another story. So that's important. And I think I mentor in a whole lot of ways, informally, for sure, and with young people and with people in the university. And I think I get a lot of informal mentoring still, and I think of colleagues and students and, you know, the Board of Governors and so forth. I think, so last word on it, I think we could have more formal programs of mentoring at the university level, and I have a new task force launched in the fall on diversity, excellence, and student engagement. It's the, you know, the next one following on student life and learning, and I think there seems to be some sense that one of the things that should come out of that is a more formal ways of both getting mentoring and serving as a mentor. But I know you do quite a bit of that and do it well here in the faculty, and I think you have that to lend to the rest of the university.
And we're always looking for other mentors, so in case you want to join up. Anyway, I'll pass it over to Cloral for...
Thank you. I'd like to go back to the concept of leadership. From with your experience, do you think that we can learn to become a leader? Do you think there is some essential rules that we should follow?
I don't know if there are rules. You know, I don't know that there are five rules about how to be a good leader, but I think that we can all learn to become good leaders, and part of it is learning who you are, what your comfort zone is, what interests you. But I think the most important thing is having role models. Sometimes they're negative role models. You know, you can think about people in your own family maybe who you thought, you know, I don't want to be like that, so I'm going to be different. Well, that's still learning about leadership. But having role models and teachers who help you see leadership ability in yourself that you wouldn't naturally see, and that can happen at any time of life, from when you're a kid to older in life, is very important, and having permission to both give and seek feedback. So I think, I believe that, so here you'll come to my prejudices now, I believe there's no room for staying the course leadership or for consolidation leadership. I think the world, whatever your enterprise, is just too competitive. And, you know, I believe in making a difference through institutions and as individuals. And so I believe in activist leadership, and I think no one can be a successful activist leadership without having peers, without having other leaders who share your ambitions, and without bringing people along, but also learning from those whom you're serving.
Obviously, you are a great leader. So what is your recipe?
Well, I don't know if the former's true, but learning is a big part of it. Caring passionately about your cause. I had an opportunity to be with some, you know, spectacular university leaders by any world standard recently, and maybe this is my background in psychiatry. I came away saying, gee, you know, some of them seem really negative, and, you know, negative about the professors, negative about the students, negative about, you know, their ability to have enough money to do what they want. And I thought, and maybe this is true again, whatever your cause is as a leader, that if you don't get some kind of biochemical lift off of the mission, off the people you're spending your time with, off of the cause that you're serving for the betterment of society, these jobs are too tough. And you've just got to feel like you're in it together, it's really worthy work, and you're making progress.
You spoke earlier about the distribution of leadership within the university. Yeah. So how do you exercise your leadership on a, let's say, day-to-day basis?
Well, there's what I call the senior administrative team of the university, and that is the deans and the vice principals and myself, the provost, and then about five other people who are at the top in the university of the domains that they run, human resources, facilities, and so forth. And that's kind of the immediate team. My desire and hope then, and the only way we can be good as, in quotes, the senior team, is that they're all consulting with their teams, and their teams are consulting with theirs, and that there's not only permission, but encouragement and incentive for people to make change at the local level, consistent with our mission as an institution, consistent with the values that we hold dear, and consistent with our overarching goals. And to the extent we succeed in that and have a broad distributed leadership and encouragement for local autonomy of expression of those goals and values and taking decisions to do the right thing, the better we'll be.
Okay. Next month will be busy for graduates because they will enter in the workforce. So what kind of advice would you give to them?
Yeah. Well, first of all, don't get hung up on having one job or one thing that you think of as your definition of success. going out into the work world. In fact, when I graduated with my Master of Social Work degree, there was a job I wanted more than anything. It was at a psychiatric institution called Homewood in Guelph, and I didn't get it. And because I didn't get it, I ended up going to McMaster Medical Center, a brand new medical center, as a social worker in a faculty of health sciences. I had a mentor who was a professor who said, you know, you should be doing more graduate work, you should do research. Nothing I've done from where I was would have predicted where I was going. And if that was true in my generation, it is way more true today, no matter what age you are or what degree you're working on, that you'll have many more turns in the road as you go. Follow, you know, corny sounding, follow your heart, follow your interests, and be with people who respect you and who you respect when you take up work. I do think that with the economic uncertainty out there, it would be terrific if we had more internship programs. Goes back to your early question, that allowed people to work on the social values and global values side of institutions and organizations while permanent jobs are uncertain, because you'll be a great asset to those sectors, and it will make you better whatever you end up doing in life. So I think that would be terrific if we could do more of that.
You talked earlier about the competition in research and academia, and what are the challenges in that field?
Well, our reputation is enormously helpful in recruiting outstanding people at whatever level, so that is a great asset. But it was not that long ago that there were only a couple of countries that were in the competition for international talent. And as you know better again than some others do, countries and continents are opening up and investing. We've just come back from a mission to India. You know, you see a science strategy in India and an ambition to have an educated, literate citizenry that ranks with the highest level of aspiration of the United States or Canada or the UK or Western Europe, same in China. And interestingly, when you look at some of these other countries and indeed continents, they're being really strategic in thinking about how they make up for lost time in advancing ahead. So they're really investing in talent. And what I find in the university context, but it's probably true in private sector as well, is that individuals want to use their talents fully, and they will compromise a bit on compensation for a good working environment, but most of all for an environment that will really take advantage of their skills and allow them to succeed. And so in a big organization that's publicly funded and has a long history, being able to create entrepreneurial activities that make this a great place in competition with now everywhere in the world is important. And I think in Quebec and in Canada, we get too caught up in thinking about competition as local. And I think we've got the deepest systems of collaborative networks here in Quebec that I've seen anywhere, and I've consulted and worked in a number of countries. But we get very narrow in our losing sight of benchmarking and understanding what's building quality in our fields nationally and internationally. And anybody can convince themselves that they're doing well or their program or their place is doing well. But if you don't know what the competition's doing and you don't collaborate with the competition in some way, you're not enriching yourself enough to compete well. So we have a big resource challenge. We have a ton of assets, and how do we bring the two together in a way that keeps us positioned for success?
You talked about McGill's reputation. So what is your plan for increase the McGill's reputation the world over?
You folks do that. You do that. But it is keeping our eye on the ball and not convincing ourselves internally that we're great in a field, and then, you know, you go out and you look at how we're doing outside and say, gee, you know, we're maybe not as good as we used to be, or we're good on that model, but you know what, the model ought to be emerging and transforming and, you know, morphing into something else, and are we as good there? So it's, you know, I don't believe in complacency, and I think complacency is is an enemy to quality and success.
Thank you. So that was
Well, I'll start by bouncing back on the idea that you were saying that McGill's rely on plans a lot to manage to guide its activities, but even the most comprehensive plans cannot take every possible scenario into account. Yeah. So how do you, as principal, deal with scenarios where McGill's strategic plans need to be adjusted to meet the challenge of the changing external circumstances, and how does this process differ from a public institution versus the private sector, which you're also familiar with?
Yeah, that's a wonderful consideration, and so it's great, and it's a challenge. How do you create a plan and do it in a disciplined way, and then have the flexibility to iterate as you both learn about what you're implementing that works and what doesn't, and you're learning about other successes and failures and incorporating those in. So I'll use our academic plan. We have a strategic academic plan. The white paper, the planning process was led by the provost, but with the input of the senior team, the departmental chairs, and consultations with the faculty. And we're now 5 years in, and we're revisiting our academic plan. And we're doing it on the basis of each of those considerations. Some new fields have emerged that we didn't think of. Fields have changed very quickly. If the last part of the last century, virtually every domain depended on, in some way or other, on an interaction of both human considerations and computer considerations, there are a lot of people who say that this is the century of biology and that virtually everything we do, from global health to environmental considerations to economic impacts, is going to be driven by some element of biology. Well, that kind of change, the interface of engineering and biology, for example, came, you know, it may have crept up, but there was kind of an insight about it overnight. So how do we say, all right, you know, we can't be who we are as McGill without taking that on? There's some other areas where, important or not, we just not moved as quickly or as effectively as other sister universities have, and where maybe we'll do better to let individuals flourish in their intellectual and academic pursuits and their teaching and their learning, but whereas institutional priorities, we might move away from that with that degree of consideration. And one beautiful thing is that sometimes, you know, fields become irrelevant. I mean, you know, diseases get put to bed. Certain kinds of human problems get put to bed. Others then emerge. So I call it a strategic planning process built iterating on the basis of our learning and our performance, because it's both.
Thank you. Being a PhD student, I also care a lot about research. Sorry, Matthew. But being in a management faculty, we kind of have the challenge of being in between two worlds, the academic world and the applied world. And in the past, you stated the importance of ongoing interaction between academic researchers and the corporate sector. So how can graduate students and faculty reconcile the competing pressure of research endeavors on the one hand and the need to demonstrate practical applications of findings from such undertakings in the other?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think that as long as we use that lens of the supporting, maintaining, reinforcing the core academic values and mission of the university, in taking the decisions we do at the programmatic level, at the funding level, at the partnership level, there's a lot we can do. And it's hard to imagine a part of the university that wouldn't benefit from collaboration, even with institutions in different sectors than us. So I think of one international organization we belong to called Universitas 21. It was actually created as a way of benchmarking public policy in support of research universities internationally. One of the most successful programs that's come out of it is collaboration of admin and support staff on major initiatives and, you know, financial information systems, HR systems, libraries, the administrative element that goes behind offering wonderful libraries. I was a vice president for research and international relations at one time and had responsibility for tech transfer. This was back in the 90s and was involved in something called the Mars Initiative in Toronto, which was a way of disseminating the findings of medical and related sciences research out into not just industry, but public policy and to practice, particularly healthcare practice. And in retrospect, we had quite a rigid notion of what tech transfer was, very legally bound, very risk-averse, very constrained on, you know, if our partner benefits financially, will we get a dollar-for-dollar benefit commensurate with that? I have a different view now, and that is that I think we'll experience benefits in a whole range of ways by collaborating, by creating opportunities, whether they're in internships or stages or little co-op opportunities or work experience. And I know that this faculty does a number of very innovative things in that way, of bringing students out into practical. But I think similarly, there's an opportunity that we probably underexpress to bring leaders, even, you know, again at the departmental level, from the private sector or from government into the university to learn from us about how we do things. And that also would enrich both the student experience and the research and scholarly experience as well. So I see it as much more fluid now than I did in the 90s, I would say.
Yeah, I think it's starting to be ongoing here also. I have another question, which is really dear from one of my PhD friends, so I have to ask it because she's going to hate me if I don't. Because PhDs, usually you get older when you get in a program, so we get with the challenge of having families when we're conducting research, completing an academic program, while caring for children. So how do you see academic life on campus improving for PhD student parents and others also? And how could McGill help provide adequate support to help students through this challenging period on campus and attain a better work-life balance? Mm-hmm.
Well, work-life balance, that's, you know, something that applies to everyone. I'm not a good ad for it, so I'm a happy person, but I think there are a lot of ways, and I think, again, the more you can do at the local level to provide support to each other, the better. I don't believe, and again, this is a personal belief, that McGill should be in the business of running daycares, of you can think of a number of in quotes, services or businesses that the university might provide to create a better quality of learning and life for our students and, frankly, for our employees. I do believe we ought to be facilitators to giving access to those. And the area where we have, of course, invested very heavily is in residences. And frankly, residences for couples and single people who have children is something to consider going forward. And we may actually have an opportunity, and I see Professor Yulofsky in the crowd. He was our vice principal for administration and finance, led a daring move to do a bond issue that has allowed us to both build and acquire residences. And Morty, I hope you feel fantastic about it, because seven and a half years ago we had a lottery for residence for first-year students, and we now have tremendous residence opportunities and a choice of kind of residence. But we don't talk enough about grad student residence. We don't talk enough about family and couple residential opportunities, and this is all part of family life. So there's another element to that, which is parental leave, for example, and I know that PGSS is working with Dean Crisworth to really think about, you know, what are models that exist in North America, what are some that we might learn from to try and create some stronger supports in that regard. And this is where, and I think it's fabulous we've stayed away from underfunding through the entire exchange on questions to this point. The fact is we suffer a gap of about $100 million a year difference in funding, size adjusted against the other research-intensive universities in Canada outside of Quebec, and closer to $500 million a year in revenues compared to the research-intensive universities in the U.S., of which we're also a part. And that expresses itself in services, in facilities, in having a number of accommodations, frankly, in student advising and mentoring and collaborations on creating practical experiences. And so the only reason why we talk about underfunding is because actually, you know, we need some things we don't have that we want to have. And the campaign goes some way to that. Changes in government investment go some way to that. But we also need to think about what our priorities are. So I think one of the questions that Dean Crisworth has presented to the graduate students is, you know, if you had to choose from amongst three or four things, where do your priorities rest on some of these considerations?
Thank you very much. I'll leave the floor back to Matthew with a question from the audience.
All right. So our first one comes from a good friend of mine and a member of the Management Undergraduate Society, Vended Prabharambi. He's right there. Hi, Vended. His question is, what was your biggest fear when you were a 21-year-old?
Whoa.
Whoa. Wow. Life. I was really shy as a child and a teenager and a young adult. I mean, painfully shy. And I fainted when I did my first class speech and when I was 11 years old, and I almost fainted when I was 13 doing it. And I married young, so I went into university. I married 5 days after I turned 20. I wasn't an epidemiologist yet, but I had some statistical notion that if I wasn't a teenager marrying a guy who came from a different cultural and religious background, who was a rock musician, and I was going to university, we probably had a good chance of the marriage succeeding if I was 20 and not 19. He was 19. So I don't know if it was magical thinking or what. So far, so good in it. But as a married student who was shy, I have always loved to learn. You know, I think I said it's one of the best things about the job is just learning, learning, learning. And the best way to be a leader is, you know, listen hard and hear and learn. I wanted to learn, but I was in a professional program, so this may apply to some of you here, where it was very small group learning. And the only way to really take advantage of it was to share, share, share. And this was, you have to know, the early 70s, when it was a pretty touchy-feely time. Don't know if that has any meaning, but anyway, it was kind of it was a special time coming off the 60s. And I felt very uncomfortable in that circumstance. And so it was just taking a deep breath each day and, you know, throwing myself into it and trying out different ways of being myself as an adult. And I think one of the great advantages to leaving town to go to university, which I didn't do, is you can reinvent yourself a bit. But if you're in your hometown and your family's next door and you're, you know, I think it's a little different. And so if you're an extrovert, that can all be good because you probably are reinventing yourself in real time all the time. But if you're shy and more inward, that can be a little tougher. And I think, again, it's part of our communal responsibility to help draw people out. What I didn't worry about, and so this is different, you know, in the early 70s, I know of no one of my generation in North America who worried about getting a job, who thought a whole lot about what they were going to do when they graduated. We had such confidence that, you know, we were I'm the end of the first third of the baby boom, and the world was about us, and the 60s, you know, for us as teenagers was, you know, it's a pretty age-specific self-centeredness, and we had just enormous confidence in terms of the work world and what would be available to us. So that's a confidence and a fear factor.
So our next question comes from MBA candidate Hannah Rakoff. I don't know if she's here. But she asks, what do you see as the unique challenges facing managers in the public sector as opposed to those working in the private sector?
I think public sector managers are facing what universities are in North America, and that is cohort renewal. The public service, and, you know, Canada's been known around the world for its federal public service, and Quebec has a long and big tradition of public service. I think it is making a transition similar to the one that I've described for university leadership, of understanding that you're there for your academic purposes, but you have to go about that with some new considerations and making room for the new generation coming in, making it an attractive place for managers, because we depend enormously in Quebec and in Canada on having a dedicated, well-educated, and progressive public service. And so I think there's enormously exciting possibility there. We actually partner, as many universities do, with the federal public service to encourage young people to come in, but also to work with managers. But I think creating a sense that change aligned with the core traditional mission can be a really exciting, whether it's a career or not. I think it probably won't be a career the way it has been, but, you know, for any one of you to go spend 5 years in the public service working into a management role and then moving out and maybe coming back in later would be terrific for public service and the recipients of those public services, but also good for other sectors that will benefit from people who've served in public service roles.
Great. So I suppose all good things must come to an end sometime. So I'd like to invite Associate Eden Toulon for some closing remarks.
Thank you very much. In closing today's session, I would just like to thank all of our participants on stage, starting first with our student representatives. I think you can tell by the insightfulness, the probing nature of the questions, go back to and reiterate essentially what the principal mentioned in her opening remarks, that we really do have the best students here in Canada, amongst the best in the world, and that's no doubt. Thank you. And obviously I would also like to thank very much the principal for taking the time to come share with us her views on leadership, McGill, the future of education, and sharing not only her professional opinion but also her personal experiences which have shaped the leader that she is today. Now, we have a small gift. It's not a McGill memorabilia, because we're sure you have plenty of that. But it is a Desotel one, and I would just like to thank again the principal for taking the time.
Thanks for the opportunity. What a joy to be here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a red bag.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thank you. Just
thank you.
Terrific.
Thank you very much.
Great pleasure.
Thank you very much.
So nice to have the opportunity.